from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Former Senator George Mitchell served as the U.S. Senate Majority Leader from 1989 to 1995. He chaired peace negotiations in Northern Ireland, and he was U.S. Special Envoy to the Middle East, facilitating the 2010-2011 Israeli-Palestinian peace talks. He'll join us to discuss the current state of Middle East peace talks and the best way to move forward for the crisis in North Korea. And it's all coming up next after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. A U.S. Special Envoy to the Middle East during the Obama administration and a key architect of the Northern Ireland Good Friday Agreement, former Senator George Mitchell has played a major role in trying to solve some of the world's most intractable conflicts. Senator Mitchell joins us this hour to speak about the current state of Middle East peace talks under the Trump administration. We'll also discuss why he thinks diplomacy and sanctions are the right approach to North Korea, and why the United States can't look to China to de-escalate the situation. He is the author of a number of books, including The Negotiator, Reflections on an American Life and a Path to Peace. And welcome, Senator George Mitchell.
Thank you for having me.
Pleased to have you, and always wanted to give you major kudos for the 1998 Good Friday Peace Agreement. I know you said publicly on a number of occasions that you were just a negotiator and you didn't play a major role, but Jerry Adams, no less, sitting in the studio, told me that you were one of really the central keys to brokering that peace. Not necessarily the success that you had in Northern Ireland and the Middle East.
That's true. While there are some similarities, there are religious differences, territorial disputes, differences of national identity, I think that the differences between the two are much greater. Indeed, no two conflicts are identical, just as no two people are identical, and each requires a very specific and unique solution. I think the situation in the Middle East is plainly more complicated, and in particular, there are more external events. It's, I think, a mistake to view the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in isolation from the region in which it exists. It's a densely packed area, a lot of turbulence and upheaval and external factors around the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that affect it, and it in turn affects those other issues. However, I do believe, and I state in the recent book I published, A Path to Peace, with my colleague and co-author Alon Zakhar, that we think that it is inevitable that the parties will recognize that despite the difficulties, mostly political difficulties in reaching an agreement, the alternative of no agreement will pose far more serious problems for both societies. And since nations like individuals ultimately act out of self-interest, we hope and expect that they will come to the conclusion that they're better off with an agreement than without one.
I remember President Clinton saying there's probably no more intractable problem. Of course, he didn't have the problems we have now with North Korea, but he said India, Pakistan, certainly in many ways intractable, but nothing more intractable than the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And you mentioned the political obstacles, and the political obstacles get into internal obstacles. I want to hear your thoughts upon this. Because within the Palestinian world, you have a real division still going on, despite the rhetoric between Hamas and between Fatah. And within Israel, you have an ongoing terrible division between those on the far right, and you could include perhaps Likud in that, and those who want peace and who want to give land for peace. And these divisions seem to be the real heart of the problem, aren't they?
You're correct.
Internal divisions.
Yes.
I mean, you said the whole region, but I realize that what's holding things up may be even more the internal problems.
Yes, there are deep internal divisions on both sides. And Alon and I have said, indeed we said in San Francisco last night and in Los Angeles on Sunday, that the principal reason we wrote the book was our concern that support for the two-state solution is declining. in Israel, among the Palestinians, and as a consequence of those two, in the United States. We think there is no realistic alternative to two-state solutions, so we wanted to lay out the case in writing why we believe that it is important that they proceed in that way. And the political obstacle is precisely the one that you described. Support for the two-state solution within Israel is declining. It's still about half the population, according to recent polls. I just add one word to your comment about peace. I think everybody wants peace. It's just that some people want peace on terms that are non-negotiable and have to be all their way, and in a conflict situation that has to be compromised on both sides. I write in the book a speculation on my part based upon spending many, many hours meeting with Prime Minister Netanyahu and many, many hours meeting with President Abbas. If they are to enter into a serious negotiation, which inevitably will involve political compromise, as political leaders, they have to have some sense that there's a prospect for success. And neither has that now, and each blames it on the other. I think that Prime Minister Netanyahu believes that President Abbas does not have the political or personal strength to enter into and reach an agreement, and therefore doesn't feel this process will work. On the other side, President Abbas doesn't believe that Prime Minister Netanyahu is serious or truthful when he says he wants a two-state solution. And he cites the many times in Prime Minister Netanyahu's past when he's been against a two-state solution, then for it, then against it, then for it, and now says the time's not right. And so since neither of them believes that a negotiation will succeed because of the other guy, there is a reluctance to engage in a way that will involve them in compromise that will be politically difficult for each of them within their own societies.
I believe you said in your negotiation book you have to have trust, and it's just missing from what you've just described. It's not there.
The absence of trust, or stated another way, the high level of mistrust, is a central obstacle to peace in any of these negotiations. It was an enormous obstacle in Northern Ireland. That's why I spent 5 years working on that effort and chaired three separate sets of discussions. At the beginning, the parties wouldn't even sit down and talk with each other. They wouldn't get in the same room. In fact, all the time I was in Northern Ireland, all the time, not once ever did I get all of the parties together in a single room at the same time.
And you say you have to have face-to-face. I mean, that's almost a given in terms of moving forward.
It is a given. But in Northern Ireland, there are 10 political parties and two governments, 12 participants. And never, ever did all 12 meet at the same time in the same room. Somebody would walk out, somebody would quit, somebody would walk in. It was like a revolving door. As we had 10, we had 11, we had 7, we had 6, we had 8, depending on the circumstances. And I, of course, spent a lot of time shuttling back and forth to their offices when they wouldn't come to a meeting.
So now we're reading that Jared Kushner, with a couple of White House officials, Dina Powell and Jason Greenblatt, is going to Saudi Arabia. This was a trip that hadn't been announced to discuss Middle East peace. And I don't know if that includes Yemen, where Saudi Arabia is, you know, involved in some serious combat. But Jared Kushner suddenly comes out of nowhere. He's named by the Trump administration as the man who's going to somehow broker peace in the Middle East. How does George Mitchell, who, you know, ardently and as Senate Majority Leader and everything, had brokered the peace in Northern Ireland, what's your response to this? Someone who has had no experience, literally none.
I wish him well, and I hope very much that he and the others who you mentioned are successful in the effort. And it may well be that the experience of the American negotiator is less significant than the circumstances that exist in the region. And they may be able to take advantage of a change in attitude among the Saudis and some of the Gulf Arabs, who I think are coming to recognize that and accept that Israel is there to stay. The United States commitment to Israel is rock solid, and that their the principal threat to them comes not from Israel, but from Iran's effort to obtain hegemony or control in the region, particularly of the petroleum resources of the Persian Gulf.
In that sense, Israel and Saudi Arabia are pretty much on the same team, aren't they, against Iran in many ways?
Both have the same highest priority in their foreign policy, and that is preventing Iranian control of the region. But because of the obstacles between them, the principal one of which is the Palestinian issue, they aren't able to coordinate their efforts, although there are many published reports of private discussions going on. One of the arguments we make in the book is that were the Israelis and Palestinians to reach an agreement, that could open the door to regional cooperation between the Israelis and not just the Saudis, but all of the Gulf Arabs, in getting together to deny Iran's efforts to obtain hegemony. So it makes a lot of sense for them to cooperate. We further make the argument that it could be really quite revolutionary in economic terms in the region to have a cooperative effort at regional development between Israel and the Palestinians. And there was a period of time during and in the immediate aftermath of the Oslo process when there were the beginnings of such cooperation. And we believe strongly that both sides would benefit enormously from that.
We're talking with former Senator, U.S. Senator George Mitchell from the state of Maine, negotiator under the Obama administration for Middle East peace and author of a couple of books. We were talking about the newest one, which is A Path to Peace, written with Alon Sachar. And a number of things I want to cover with the senator in addition to talking about the Middle East. And, of course, we'll give you an opportunity to bring in any questions or comments you might have. But let me just be local for a moment, because those gas explosions in San Bruno, which everybody locally remembers, they actually invited you to come in and talk about the size of the fines. And then there was no question about your bona fides and how qualified you were to do that. But there was a question about your selection, because it was a selection by the PUC. And so that became an issue, a major issue, didn't it?
Well, I was asked to serve as a mediator. Mediation is a voluntary process in which all parties must consent to the mediation itself and to the mediator. And in this case, one or more of the parties did not consent to mediation. I don't think it had anything to do with
me. No, it was the PUC deciding or inviting
They did not want to engage in a mediation. Apparently, they felt that their position was stronger to proceed in other ways. And so I never actually participated. I have engaged in a number of large commercial and public mediations. But again, it is a completely voluntary process. All parties must agree to participate. No one is bound to continue. They can leave at any time they want. And if they are able to conclude a successful result, that's fine. If they're not, then they go back to either their lawsuit or their arbitration or whatever proceedings they choose to resolve the dispute.
Well, there was some serious mediation done by former President Carter with Sadat and Begin in terms of brokering a peace in the Middle East. And now President Carter is offering to go to North Korea, because he actually did negotiate with Kim Jong-un, the father of Kim Jong-il. Let me rephrase that. Kim Jong-il, the father of Kim Jong-un. You've said only sanctions and diplomacy can work in North Korea. And what about President Carter being a special envoy? I mean, if President Trump were to agree to that, do you think there would be something positive in that?
That's a decision for both President Trump and former President Carter to make. What I've said in response to questions on the issue is to repeat what our own military officials have said, that there does not appear to be a viable military response to the issue. And because of the geography, the large population in South Korea, which is in close proximity to the border, including 100,000 Americans and some 20,000 to 30,000 American military personnel who would be subjected to immediate attack, artillery and rocket fire from North Korea. So for a variety of reasons, our military has concluded that there really isn't a credible military option, and that leaves sanctions and diplomacy. That's not a very pleasant alternative because we have imposed sanctions for a long time. We've tried diplomacy. It hasn't worked. And people say, well, why do you keep trying since it didn't work in the past? There's an argument to that. The counter-argument is that you have to keep trying. In Northern Ireland, I've said many times, we had 700 days of failure and one day of success. Almost every day I was asked by reporters as I left the compound where the negotiations were held, well, you failed to get an agreement. When are you going home? So I think we have to keep trying.
Is that the old definition of insanity? You keep doing the same thing over and over again and failing every time?
That's right. That's the definition of insanity. There's also a saying says, try, try again. Don't give up. Don't acknowledge defeat. So you can choose your slogan. I think in this case, the options are ranged from poor to terrible. And
there are no real options.
There is no real good option.
I mean good option.
There is no good option. No. But the option of imposing increased sanctions and hopefully negotiating. I do believe you made a comment in the introduction about China that each American president in recent decades has fallen back on let China do it. China does share with us a short-term interest in stability in the region. They obviously don't want an upheaval in the region. But in the longer term, China's interests are diametrically opposite those of the United States. The American policy is that we want a unified Korea in a democratic regime. We want a democracy there, the people to choose for themselves their form of government. That's totally in contradiction to China's interests. The last thing they want is a unified democratic regime on the Korean Peninsula, an American ally with American military forces on their border. So for us to say that, to think they're going to solve the problem for us, I think is just kidding ourselves. They may be helpful in the short term in trying to prevent upheaval, but they don't want regime change. They don't want an alteration of the situation.
They don't want hundreds of thousands of refugees pouring in over
exactly
the Chinese border
right.
either.
Yes.
And what about when President Trump uses this sort of rhetoric talking about locked and loaded and fury and fire and so forth?
I think those words are unnecessary and unwise, largely because, not because I think that the United States is going to launch a nuclear attack of its own. I do not believe that to be an outcome that is likely to occur. But because you have a young man heading North Korea, obviously ruthless, has directed the execution of his uncle, apparently the assassination of his half-brother, and many others, but suffers the impairment that all dictators suffer, is that they don't get good information about what's going on in the world. They're so used to having everything done their way and shooting anyone who doesn't agree with them.
But accepting the shooting, so there are some who say the same of our present chief executive, that he gets the information filtered to him from mainly singular sources?
No, I don't think any American president can possibly avoid the reality because we have a free and open press. We have a vigorous open political debate. We have opposition parties. He might not like it, but he's...
You can call it fake news if it doesn't suit him.
Well, but he's aware of it, and that has to have some tempering effect on his attitude. I don't think the situations are in any way comparable. But my point is that the president's statements may lead Kim Jong-un to himself make a misjudgment about what America is or is not likely to do, and induce him to take a military action that would be extremely unwise from his standpoint in the long run. And so while I think we ought to be firm in our policy toward them, I think the overheated rhetoric, the big talking stuff, doesn't advance our interests, and we ought to heed the words of President Theodore Roosevelt, walk softly and carry a big stick.
Our guest is former U.S. Senator, former Senate Majority Leader from the state of Maine, George Mitchell, and he's the author of a memoir, The Negotiator, Reflections on an American Life, and a book called A Path to Peace, which he co-authored with Alon Sakar. And let me invite you to join us. We're talking about the Middle East. We're talking about North Korea, about really the art of negotiation and the importance of mediation and how it works and sometimes runs up against terrible obstacles. We do indeed want your involvement in the program, and let me tell you how you can be involved with any questions or comments you might want to bring to the fore. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. We do welcome your call, so join us now at that number, 866-733-6786. You can also email questions or comments, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website and post them there, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @kqedforum. Leaving the Paris deal, you said, was a historic mistake, and I spoke about this a little bit before with Steve Forbes because he was talking about China and how you can't breathe the air there, and I said that Senator Mitchell has said on a few occasions that China's, and certainly been said by others on this air, China's becoming the energy leader some now because of that. And he defended President Trump's actions of pulling out of Paris because he said it was a bad deal. We had to pay much more money than China and India and so forth.
I think that's categorically wrong, and I respectfully disagree with my friend Steve. The fact is, of course, it's a voluntary agreement, and the targets are set individually by each nation. And we are polluting more than anyone other than China now, and we're trying to get all of the countries in the world to join in an effort to deal with what is an obvious issue. The overwhelming weight of scientific evidence is that the Earth is warming and that man-made activities contribute to that warming. The president has said that global warming is a hoax perpetrated by China to harm the American economy, a truly absurd statement. The director of the Environmental Protection Agency, appointed by the president, does not acknowledge the man-made portion of the contribution toward climate change and global warming. The United States, if it does in fact withdraw, will forfeit its leadership in the world. It's significant, I think, that 194 countries support the agreement, and the only three that do not are Nicaragua, Syria, and the United States. And to say that that it's a bad deal for the United States, in my judgment, is simply incorrect, and it's an apology for pursuit of a policy that contradicts science, that contradicts the overwhelming conclusion of scientists around the world about the problem, which is a very serious challenge here in the United States, and it's a reality now.
Which brings up the question again of where does the president get his news? We don't necessarily have to go back to that. We're talking to George Mitchell, and we will indeed be talking to you, getting your comments and questions. We invite them, and we do want to hear from you. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum. We'll speak more with a former senator. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're discussing the art of negotiation and the Middle East peace process and North Korea and climate change agreement in Paris that the United States is no longer a participant of, and a number of other things with former U.S. Senator George Mitchell. And we do welcome your involvement with any questions or comments. You can join us at our toll-free number. The number to call is 866-733-6786. And we do indeed want to hear what you have to say or what you have to ask. There is a question that I want to ask you before we go to our callers and emailers, and it has to do with Syria. If people get in a sense of almost nowhere to go in a cul-de-sac with respect to Israeli-Palestinian problem, they get the same thing. And in fact, I think there's probably reason to feel that way also about doing something about money and politics, which I would love to talk with you about as well. Because when you were Senate Majority Leader, you were able to broker a lot of deals with Bob Dole, who was Minority Leader, just again with negotiation skills and with being upfront and being honest and truthful and all of those kinds of things, which people normally don't associate with politicians, but you write about with candor and you write about with passion. I'm wondering, though, about Syria. I mean, can there be a political solution to what's going on in Syria, in your judgment?
Well, there will ultimately be an end to the fighting and a political solution of some sort, whether it is or is not acceptable to the people of Syria or to the United States or others remains to be seen, and that's the central issue.
Even that sounds optimistic because it seems almost like an endless war to many, and it is.
No wars are endless. They all eventually come to an end, this one will as well at some point. I think you have to place it in a broader context. On the death of the Prophet Muhammad 1,400 years ago, two political groups formed to gain control of the caliphate that he had built. The differences were not religious. They were political, a struggle for power.
What about Sunni and Shia?
The prevailing faction became the Sunni. The losing faction became the Shia. And over the past 1,400 years, they have been in conflict. Long periods of remission, briefer but intense periods of violent upheaval. And we're now in a very intense period of upheaval. It's manifested in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen, to some degree in Pakistan, and across the whole range of North Africa. That's going to continue for some time. It's not going to be resolved when this round of fighting ends in Syria, depending upon the political composition of whatever emerges from this struggle. It's been extremely difficult, very complicated. The United States has made mistakes. I believe President Obama made a mistake to draw a red line in Syria and then, when it was crossed, not act upon it. On the other hand, what he was urged to do was to fire some missiles. President Trump did fire some missiles, and it had zero effect on the continuation or outcome of the conflict.
Like there's still talk about poison gas use by Assad even now.
And it did not alter the balance of power in any way. There is no way that the United States could have exerted its military leverage without what I think would be unacceptable to Americans, deep military involvement, troops on the ground, which nobody in the United States, Republicans or Democrats, would have supported. Now, I do believe that while Assad may remain in power for some period of time, his conduct has been so brutal, the killing of so many of his own people, the upheaval that has uprooted a very substantial portion of their population, either into leaving the country or internally displaced, that there won't be a calming until the point in time comes when he leaves and they have some sort of successor regime. And I think that will inevitably be a Sunni-dominated regime because they comprise 80% of the population. Assad's
an Alawite, which is even a smaller minority of Shia.
It's an offshoot of Shia Muslim. They represent about 10 or 12% of the population. And I think when the Russians initially moved into Syria, it was in part a reflection of the 50-year history of Russian involvement there. They have a very long involvement because they have a warm water port in Syria, their access to the Mediterranean Sea. There are many Russian men who went there as military and political and intelligence who married Syrian women who lived there. And I believe that what Putin's initial intention was to make sure there was an enclave, a safe enclave, in case Assad fell, for the Alawites to go to. And in the ultimate partition of the country, they would have had their own home area. It's beyond that now. So it's a very difficult and complicated situation, not likely to be resolved in a manner that we would prefer at the outset, but in the long term, I think the outcome is clear. Assad can't remain forever in power, and I think the Sunnis will eventually gain control.
Well, we're going to go to our callers now. I should also mention, I didn't know until I read more about you that your background, your mother was Lebanese and your father was Irish, so you've
That's right.
I mean, two of your major accomplishments and efforts have been in the Middle East and in Ireland.
Complete serendipity.
Let me go to our callers. Let me begin with Damien. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hello, and thank you again, and great to talk with you, Mr. Senator Mitchell. I have to disagree with you on Syria, but that's a whole other issue. But my question is this. Is the United States a really an honest broker with between Israel and the Palestinians? From my perspective, it seems more like the Israelis and Palestinians face each other over a table, and the United States sits behind Israel with its big arms and its big head and its big gun, and the Palestinians really have no one on their side. Am I mischaracterizing it? And just my last point is this. In the United States, we currently have a law that's trying to be passed in California that you cannot boycott Israel. And the United States in general is so pro-Israel that it's sort of sick. So I'll take my answer off the
air. All right, Damien, thank you for the call. And let me add something on to Damien's question, Aaron, because I'm looking at a comment from Robert who says, what former Senator Mitchell omits in his statements on the Israel-Palestine situation is that the politics of the U.S. prevent movement toward any agreement. There is blind support in the U.S. government for Israel, no matter what it does or what position it takes. If the U.S. were no longer to support Israel and whatever it wants, the Israelis might actually move toward a solution.
Who said that?
This is another listener. So you're getting that same name, Robert.
No, yes.
Damien and Robert are saying essentially the United States is the problem, obstacle to peace in the Middle East.
Yes. I respectfully but strongly disagree with those comments. First off, the United States does support Israel. They are an ally, a close ally. We have an ironclad commitment to their security, to their ability to live safely and securely behind defensible borders. But that does not preclude our supporting a Palestinian state. If you go on your computers and pull up a speech by President George W. Bush in Jerusalem in January of 2008, he told an assembled group of Israeli and Palestinian leaders. They were then in negotiations, the so-called Annapolis process initiated by President Bush, which was a serious effort, although it did not ultimately succeed. He told them that, and I'm paraphrasing, but I think it's accurate, Israelis, you have a state, a very successful state, but you don't have security for your people on a sustainable basis. People live in fear and anxiety. You can only get that if the Palestinians get a state. And to the Palestinians, he said, you want a state, but you cannot get it until the people of Israel have reasonable and sustainable security. So each should be vested in the other's success, because that's the only way they can get what they want. And I believe that was an accurate statement, both of American policy and of the reality of the situation. It is true we are close to Israel, but that does not prevent us from also supporting the Palestinian position for a state. And in fact, many Palestinians recognize and acknowledge that the United States has been of enormous assistance to them, both financially and in helping to organize and train their internal security forces that's enabled them to build the institutions needed to manage a state when that time comes. And I believe it will come, because I think it's the only realistic way that Israelis can get security and a long-term sense of stability for their people. And for the Palestinians, they have to acknowledge and recognize, as the Palestinian Authority has. They've recognized Israel. They accept prior agreements. They renounce the use of force and violence against Israelis. That's the policy of the governing authority of the Palestinians on the West Bank. And I think that ultimately they'll recognize it's in their best interest to reach an agreement with American support.
Then what about Gaza, though? I mean, because the argument comes back that under Hamas there is non-acceptance of Israel. In fact, there is dedication to the abolition of the State of Israel coming from Hamas, and that's been pretty consistent all along.
Yes, well, Hamas disagrees with
Israel did give up land of Gaza for Hamas to essentially establish their state.
Yes, well, unfortunately, Israel withdrew unilaterally, not in coordination with the Palestinian Authority, which created a condition which permitted Hamas to gain control of Gaza after a brief military conflict.
But the argument goes on in Israel, if we give up land for a two-state solution, we'll have the same result that we had with Hamas and Gaza.
Well, the counter-argument is they gave up land to Egypt, and they've had a peace agreement now for 38 years that has held, and it is a pillar of Israeli security, because that was done in negotiation with the opposition. It was done in stages in a way that permitted, that prevented what occurred in Gaza. So you can argue it both ways. The reality is that And I believe, ultimately, Hamas is going to change its policies and positions and come to the view held by the Palestinian Authority that the only way forward is through recognition of Israel and peaceful negotiation. However, that requires Israelis to recognize that that's the policy, that's the group of Palestinians that they have to negotiate with, and they have to give them some hope and opportunity. Otherwise, the Palestinian Authority will not be able to maintain its position of security cooperation with the Israelis. And that's very important to Israel. That's why over 200 Israeli former generals, why the entire security and military establishment in Israel favors a two-state solution, because they recognize the importance of the security coordination between Israel and the Palestinian Authority.
But Netanyahu has to fight his own battles against, and will not fight them for the most part, will accommodate to the right and extreme political views, especially of the ultra-Orthodox in Israel, who do not want that solution.
Yeah, but Abbas has his own problems.
Yes, he
does.
In fact, most of the polls show that the Palestinians in the West Bank are not behind Abbas.
But the support is declining because they have seen Abbas for 20 years pursuing a policy of nonviolence and peaceful negotiation and getting nowhere. When Hamas attacked Israel and took prisoner Corporal Shalit several years ago, it was a tremendously emotional and important issue in Israel to get him back. And so the Israelis negotiated with Hamas, and they negotiated a deal where the Israelis exchanged 1,000 Palestinian prisoners for Corporal Shalit. And I urged Prime Minister Netanyahu to release some prisoners to Abbas and the Palestinian Authority, because prisoners are just as emotional and important on the Palestinian side as they are on the Israeli side. And my argument was, if you release 1,000 prisoners to Hamas and none to the Palestinian Authority, the message you're conveying is that violence pays. Attacking Israel and taking prisoners pays off. Peaceful non-negotiation does not.
And as I recall, Netanyahu took your advice.
He did not take my advice.
I mean, did not take your advice.
Did not take my advice, and that was the message that was conveyed, not just to the Palestinians, but to all of the Arabs. It has to be reciprocal. They both have to get into serious negotiations, be willing to make concessions on both sides. They have to stay in negotiations. The Palestinians, the last time we had it during our tenure, left, I think, prematurely. And they have to stay in negotiations until they get an agreement.
Let me bring some more callers on here. We'll go next to Jay. Thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you, Michael. And thank you, Senator. It's an honor to talk to you, and thank you for your service. I would like to talk about one of the many elephants in the room with Israel and Palestine, which is the Palestinian media, which any of the listeners could just go PAL Watch on YouTube, and they're teaching an entire generation in their local media and their local schools to absolutely hate Israel, to say that they want Palestine, the key to Palestine goes from the river to the sea, militancy, adoration of martyrdom. And they're teaching a whole generation. Why doesn't anybody talk about this? And does this not kind of mean that they're really, the Palestinian side is really not serious about this?
You say, why don't people talk about it? It's been talked about a great deal.
Yes, on this program, too.
There's been extensive discussion in this country, in Israel, and within the Palestinian territories on that subject. And indeed, I personally raised that with President Abbas on many occasions. We have encouraged them to reduce incitement, make full their policy of nonviolence. That is, not just have it involve the use of arms, but in fact the kind of subjects that you describe. These are emotional issues. Of course, the Palestinians will then pull out statements by some religious leaders in Israel that are extreme and highly derogatory toward Palestinians. They will try to make comparisons with others saying the same thing. I don't think there is an equivalence, but I do think that emotions are very high on both sides. And we have we urge the Palestinians as a part of our effort to create an atmosphere in which negotiations could be held and succeed, to reduce incitement, to control better and more effectively what people are saying, so as not to have the kind of reproaches that you described. They do continue to some extent, although I will say they have decreased sharply, particularly in the area of the Friday sermons in the mosque. There are very little there of the kinds of extreme statements that previously existed in that regard.
Forgive me, Senator, but it seems to me that that both sides dehumanize each other to extremes, and that's part of the problem because they don't have contact with each other. I mean, there are a lot of Palestinians who live in Israel and a lot of Palestinians who work in Israel, but in terms of those who are living in Gaza, for example, there's no contact at all. Let me thank the caller, and let me get to another caller here, and that's you. Ford, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I don't understand our continued hostility towards Iran. First, it seems that Persia for millennia was a regional power, and that it should be a reasonable expectation on our part that they have regional aspirations. And yet we seem hell bound on a containment strategy that seems not to recognize their reasonable regional aspirations. And secondly, we have some positive history with Iran up to Eisenhower and the Dulles brothers. We got along and were supportive of Iranian aspirations. And can we get back to that place? And that's I'll take my answer.
Okay, it's a good question. A lot of people thought we might be moving there when Rouhani was elected, but there still seems to be major division and enmity. Your thoughts, Senator?
Well, first, of course, there is nothing unusual about any nation seeking to influence events, particularly those in close proximity to it geographically, in its favor. Virtually every large nation has done so. Indeed, if you go back and read Greek history, it's largely a struggle for control of the Mediterranean between the Greek city-states and the Persian Empire. There has been a Persian nation for thousands of years, and that's the heart of what is now Iran. The emphasis on control of the region was greatly accelerated, and the focus shifted from the Mediterranean more to the Gulf with the discovery of oil and the presence of large reserves beneath the Persian Gulf and in that region, and Iran has sought to influence that. It didn't begin with the Ayatollahs. Indeed, it began under the Shah when their military forces, American-supplied, occupied a few small islands off the coast of what is now the United Arab Emirates.
And forgive me, there was tremendous resentment for helping the Shah get into power and the United States' role in that, and the CIA specifically.
Well, depending upon your point of view. I mean, there are
I'm talking about the Iranian point of view. It was one of the excuses that was offered our embassy was taken over.
But they are supporting and assisting groups who seek to pursue their goals through the use of terror and military force. And
you're talking about Revolutionary Guard largely? Are you talking largely about the Revolutionary Guard?
Well, the Revolutionary Guards, Hezbollah, Hamas, and other groups.
I was thinking specifically in Iran,
And so we naturally support our allies who oppose that effort. Now, my own view is that the agreement that President Obama struck with Iran on their nuclear program was very beneficial to the United States and to the region. It doesn't eliminate Iran's effort to influence events in the region in their favor, but it makes them far less successful if they're not a nuclear power in doing so. And that was the purpose of the agreement. President Trump's decision to apparently withdraw from it, although he's punted it to Congress, I think is a serious and an historic mistake in that regard. The Iranian people were Western-oriented. I believe that the vast majority of them still are to this day. And every American visitor to Iran reports being received very warmly and welcomely. But the government, which is now controlled by the Ayatollahs and is a military dictatorship, doesn't have majority support. They couldn't win a fair election. They have to rig the elections to stay in power, and they use terror and force and the threat of force to maintain themselves in power. what Obama tried to do, which I think is the right policy, was prevent them from getting nuclear weapons and try to bring about an evolution and a change in attitude and policy toward the rest, a recognition that their best interests lie in returning to that approach.
But the counter-argument you hear is they're moving ahead with their missile program despite the agreement, and they seem to be, as you suggested, fomenting a great deal of terrorism.
But in terms of the missiles, that's not covered under the nuclear agreement.
I know.
That's a separate issue, and we ought to strongly push back on that, as we are doing. But that doesn't mean that you tear up the nuclear agreement. In other words, the argument of those who opposed the nuclear arms agreement is, well, sanctions got them to the table, and we produced this result. So why don't we just pull out and increase the sanctions? The problem with that argument is that it's a myth. The sanctions did get them to the table because the sanctions were effective, because they were universal. It wasn't just the United States imposing sanctions. Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany imposed sanctions. Universal sanctions are fully effective. Unilateral sanctions, far less so.
And if we rip up the deal, it's going to be probably us going alone, don't you think?
Well, all five countries have already said they will not reimpose the sanctions. So for someone to stand up and say, let's reimpose the sanctions, it's a myth. It won't happen in the form that existed before. So I don't disagree with the fact that we should be trying to persuade them to modify their policies, but as we do so, we must strenuously resist the efforts that they are making to encourage terror, force, and the use of arms as a way to advance their policies and their influence.
Again, we're talking to former U.S. Senator George Mitchell, who's here with us in studio. I would be remiss if I didn't ask you just to put the spotlight on domestic concerns for the moment. You turned down a Supreme Court nomination, and later on, you can correct me if I'm wrong about this, but express some regret because of Citizens United, which I believe you said was one of the least persuasive documents that you've ever read in your entire life. I think I have that right. In fact, you also said it put gasoline on the fire of tying up money into politics.
Right.
And so we have it, and what do we do about it?
I did say those things, and let me put them in the context in which I stated them. I was asked, do I regret turning down an appointment to the Supreme Court? And I said, only occasionally, and most often when I read and reread the Supreme Court decision in Citizens United. I believe that's that, and it's a series of cases. It's kind of complicated, not just a single case. Represents about the worst decision made by any Supreme Court in modern history. Because what it did, it didn't create the problem of money in politics. That's existed long before we were around, and it will continue forever. But it made it much worse. We have a political system that is corrupted by money, corrupted by money. The trust of the American people in their political leaders has been severed because most Americans believe that the political leaders are more responsive to their donors than they are to their constituents, and they act out of self-interest and self-preservation as opposed to the national interest. There are two ways to deal with it, to limit the amount of money that can go into political campaigns and be expended by political campaigns, and secondly, by making fully transparent who gives what to whom. And we now have the worst of both worlds.
When you were in office, were you pushing for those things?
Well, I was the principal author of legislation with former Senator Boren of Oklahoma, of legislation which did revise the campaign finance system. And President Bush vetoed the bill. We passed the bill. We couldn't override his veto.
And you were behind McCain-Feingold as well?
Oh, yes, but that's only a small part of it. You have to do a lot more than that. And what I want to say to you is that we're now getting billions of dollars going into the political process and no transparency as to who's giving what to whom. So we have the worst of both worlds. And I think, unfortunately, now it's not likely, but the time will come when the Supreme Court will say that this Supreme Court is wrong when it says that you cannot impose limits constitutionally on amounts contributed and expenditures made in campaigns. And I think the decision is just plain wrong. And I challenge anyone to go try to read the decision. It's dense and it's illogical and it's very poorly written. And I think it is one of the least persuasive opinions ever presented by the United States Supreme Court.
We had a debate on it. It's in our archives, and a number of debates on it. It's certainly come up through the years and will continue to come up. Quick question from Jim. Why can't we stay in the Paris Agreement and just withhold what we consider to be more than our share until others agree to step up?
Well, the president could have done that. In fact, we're not out of the agreement yet. There is a process for withdrawal, and the president's decision was only the first step. There may still be time to hopefully persuade this president or the next president to stay in and continue our efforts at whatever level we choose to participate in.
Senator Mitchell, pleasure, honor to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mike.
George Mitchell, U.S. former senator, U.S. from Maine, and also the author of a memoir called The Negotiator, Reflections on American Life, and a new book called A Path to Peace, which is co-authored with Alan Sachar. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. You can, indeed, we encourage you to continue this discussion online simply by going to kqed.org/forum. Tomorrow in this hour, we'll be talking to a couple of famed restaurateurs, local restaurateurs, and to Joyce Maynard, who's written a memoir. Hope you will join us for that. And probably in the opening hour, we'll take up what's being discussed right now as we speak on Capitol Hill with respect to the role that social media should be playing in the future in elections. Thank you for being a part of today's program. And for all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.